Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 2007, a brand new year, and maybe time, high time for some brand new thinking. It's easy to get stuck in a rut in ways of thinking that lag the world and its changes. A new year is a good time to look at new possibilities, maybe a whole new mindset. Americans have spent much of this decade in a post-9/11 box of fear and apprehension. Maybe it's time to move on, alert, but reimagining what's possible, rethinking our reflexes. In this hour, we'll talk with celebrated historian Eric Foner and political scientist David Layton about possibilities, opportunities, looking afresh at the world and America's place in it. Up next, On Point, testing our mindsets with some fresh thinking for a brand new year. We've invited a couple of noted big thinkers this hour to help us along. Joining me first from New York is Eric Foner, professor of history at Columbia University. The Washington Post describes him as one of the most prolific, creative, and influential historians of the past 20 years. His books include The Story of American Freedom, Who Owns History, and Forever Free, The Story of Emancipation and Reconstruction. Eric Foner, Happy New Year. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Very happy to be here. Thank you.
And with us from Stanford, California, David Layton joins us. He's professor of political science at Stanford University. Foreign Affairs magazine calls his work social science at its best. He's written extensively on terrorism and civil war. Professor David Layton, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
All right. It's kind of a big canvas we've laid out here, and we're not sure what we're going to put on it. We've got the courage to do it because you two are with us. Eric Foner, we thought we'd try this in part because it does feel, as a country, we're at some kind of hinge moment here. You've looked famously at Civil War Reconstruction, another great big hinge moment in American history. You've looked at a lot of history. Before we even get into what it might be, do you have the sense of the country here, almost at the dawn of 2007, at a point where it's ready to kind of rethink the way it's been looking at itself in the world or not?
Well, I hope so. Of course, last year during the election campaign, one of the most striking, you know, public opinion poll results was on this question, are we on the right track or the wrong track? Mm-hmm. And a significant majority of Americans thought the country is on the wrong track. Now, that's not a very specific critique, but mm-hmm. it does suggest that receptivity to new thinking is out there, as it has been at many times in our past. The problem is, you know, I'm not a political pundit analyzing every moment that, you know, everything that happens in Congress, but it still does seem that we are very polarized as a country, that partisanship is extremely rife. New thinking is going to require both parties to, you know, really move away from the stridency of the last several years under the Bush administration, certainly, and you know, be willing to maybe slough off some very cherished ideas. Is that possible? I don't know. Even though I think there's a great desire for it, whether it happens in Washington remains to be seen.
Give us a little historical perspective here, Eric Foner. I mean, you're here. We've invited you exactly because you're not a political pundit. You've watched and studied Absolutely. A lot of American history. How do sort of new mindsets, new fundamental perceptions get into currency in this country? And well, can you do it without stridency?
No, of course. Stridency is an important part of politics. I mean, a lot of the new thinking in our history has come from outside of so-called the Beltway through social movements, whether it's the abolitionist movement or the women's suffrage movement or the labor movement. People who have not actually been directly involved in political action, taking to the streets or publicizing their views among public opinion. Usually, people in power are the last ones to kind of get the message. You know, and of course, there are many such social movements out there in the country today. Sometimes they seem rather fragmented and often at cross purposes. But that's one, you know, basic way in our history that new ideas have entered the political mainstream, through these outside groups, you know, pressuring for change. And then, of course, there is the question which Professor Layton knows much more about than I do, which is political leadership. You know, I think that's where we have failed, really have a tremendous vacuum at the top right now of just lack of actual leadership, of lack of a willingness to confront big problems. And one of the key things about leadership, you mentioned the Civil War, you know, Lincoln, of course, the greatest example, is the willingness and ability to change. You know, in 1862, on the eve of emancipation, Lincoln said, "The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. We have to disenthrall ourselves from our previous ideas." Well, that's how you start changing, by recognizing that you have to disenthrall yourself. But I haven't seen any evidence of that coming from the top in this administration on any issue. I'm not even – forget about Iraq, which everybody knows plenty about, whether it's domestic policy, global warming, civil liberties, you name it. So in the absence of any genuine leadership at the top of the political system, I think it's from these grassroots movements that new ideas are probably going to be generated.
And the beauty is, right here in this forum, we don't have to wait on any leadership. We can push the ideas wherever they go. And I'm curious, I'll come back, Eric Funder, to ask you sort of where you think we are at this moment in terms of the nation's sense of itself relative to earlier eras. But David Layton, same big question to you. Are we, as a nation, and it's a giant question, almost too big, and yet it matters, are we at a moment, in your view, where we're ready to disenthrall ourselves, as Eric Foner says, quoting Abraham Lincoln, from the kind of mindset we've been in of the last, you name it, number of years?
Well, Tom, my forecast or my sense is far more modest. I think that the coming year will be one in which merely reality will trump ideology, where the Bush administration will be compelled to adjust policy to the facts on the ground, rather than sustaining failed and dangerous policies that have been basically based on faith. Can I give you a few examples?
Please.
Just to start things off? First is the reality that the American-led occupation of Iraq has failed. It has brought neither security nor democracy. This reality led the Iraq Study Group to recommend a strategy that can only be interpreted as retreat with dignity. The so-called surge that's bandied about by the administration circles today can postpone facing this reality perhaps for a few months, but it is a reality that the administration cannot for long endure or ignore. The Bush team will be compelled, and I believe it will be this year, to negotiate the terms of an honorable retreat.
Is that going to mean a different American attitude? The Iraq Study Group is famous on all fronts for putting the word failure out here, and even the president followed afterward. How do you see that idea of a failure integrating itself into the sort of fundamental American mindset or view of the world, David Layton?
I think the American mindset will be watching, perhaps in some relief, that the administration's grandiose ideas of bringing world change are somewhat relaxed and facing the reality that all of us can observe on TV every day. Mm. For example, as a second example, Secretary Rice's democracy initiative, it clearly has backfired. The median voter in many countries is anti-American, and this makes democracy promotion troublesome for our interests. Think of Hamas's victory in Palestine, Ahmadinejad's victory in Iran, Morales's victory in Bolivia, and Chavez as democratically elected leader of Venezuela. Mm. In the coming year, I think, U.S. common interests with Russia and with Ethiopia, thinking about the Somali case, suggest that the reality of national interests, compelling us to develop productive relations with Democrats turned dictators, will trump the messianic mission of Rice's democracy promotion everywhere.
So more real politic? Is that the future you're seeing in that?
That is coming to terms with realpolitik rather than messianic desires to transform the world. And one factor that will push this is the reality that the Bush administration will have to face of American democracy that will compel the administration to subject its policies to congressional scrutiny, something it hasn't had to do for 5 years. Cabinet secretaries will no longer have Teflon-coated hearings to justify their ideologically driven policies. The realities, rather than the myths of Social Security, of health care, of global warming, and of the minimum wage, will be thrust upon the administration, I think, in daily doses. So that's the reality that will be forced upon them.
Eric,
and finally,
oh, yes, please.
Finally, is the reality, and we haven't discussed the economy yet, is the, of our budget and trade deficits and the Treasury bill ownership of American debt, largely by foreign central banks. This reality may strike any time, I think, this year, next year, or maybe a few years down the line. But a run on the dollar set off by China, by South Korea, or by Japan would have a devastating impact on American economic security and the world economy. Bush's tax cuts for the wealthy and his refusal to tax Americans for our war on terror have helped create an economic reality that eventually will have to be faced squarely. So let me sum up and say this is a year where reality might well strike an administration that up till now has been largely impervious to it.
We're sort of out here, again, on that blank canvas. But you know, we have many strands of national mythology, and I mean that with respect in this case. So here we are, 2007. How do you see what's been the operative mindset, the things we've been drawing on out of our history? And are we at a point where we might put on some different clothes from that old wardrobe?
Yeah, well, let me give you an example of a basic piece of the American mindset that I think might be shelved for a while, and that is the notion of American exceptionalism, that we somehow are a unique nation in the world with a kind of mission to spread our particular values and beliefs and dogmas to everybody else. Now, you know, everybody is exceptional in some ways. Nobody would say that France is equivalent to Germany or that Russia is the same as China. But our exceptionalism is a little different. Most countries don't think that they are a model to the whole rest of the world. As American leaders and many and people have since the time of the American Revolution, whether it's Lincoln, you know, the last best hope of man, or Jefferson, the empire of liberty. But unfortunately, especially lately, this kind of mindset leads to a certain hubris, you know, the notion that we have all the answers. You can go back and read the National Security Strategy of 2002, which began by saying there is a single sustainable model of society for the world. Guess who has that? We do. And our job is to sort of remake everybody else according to our model. There's a different American tradition, which I think we ought to try to rediscover, which has sort of gone into abeyance, and that's in the Declaration of Independence, where the founders said, you know, we have to exhibit a decent respect to the opinions of mankind. That's why they wrote the Declaration, to explain to mankind why there was this revolution. If we can move away from our exceptionalism and to think about that we might learn from other people. I mean, just one example. Take this notion of the crisis of health care. You know, every country in the world has a health system. Some of them work well. Some of them don't work very well. But how many times have you heard someone in Congress say, well, let's go and look at what other countries are doing. What are they doing in France? What are they doing in Denmark? What are they doing in Japan?
A lot of countries where they're living longer and spending less than we are.
Yeah, exactly. But, I'm not even saying let's adopt this plan or that plan. I'm saying let's get out of the mindset that we have all the answers and that we have nothing to learn from the rest of mankind.
Let us pick that one up. David Layton, as it happens, we're going to be talking tomorrow with Robert Kagan. You know, he's got this new book out, Dangerous Nation, looking back at American exceptionalism. In his case, he's a conservative, kind of applauding this, saying, look, we've always reached out to assert American values on this continent and well beyond. But what about it, David Layton? Is that something Americans can lay down? Here we are in a globalized era, we're told. It seems like a time when you kind of have to stand up for what you believe in, or it gets washed away in a global tide.
I completely agree that having our values and setting our values clearly for democracy and for individual freedom, for human rights, for fair treatment of workers around the world, these are values which we should promote because they're important to us, and I think we can justify them morally. But the problem that we face is that the world isn't as simple as us good guys and them bad guys, an axis of evil and we are all good. The world is much more complex than the Bush administration has led us to believe, and it leads to some bizarre and difficult problems because we see the world in black and white terms rather than in more nuanced ways. And if I may, I'll give just one example of this in the current war going on in Somalia, that the United States has decided to use Ethiopia as a proxy to overcome an al-Qaeda-linked regime which had taken control
of Somalia.
And this is not the worst policy in the world to support this and to bring the transitional federal government into power where it had been almost in exile in a town called Baidoa. But the problem is, once we use President Meles of Ethiopia as our interlocutor,
a fairly authoritarian leader, even dictator there, yeah.
he was a Democrat and democratically elected, but with authoritarian sort of goals, and turning into a dictator in the last election, it was close to moving towards dictatorship. Well, now, if he refuses to put himself up for election for the next electoral cycle, because we are beholden to him for what he has done in our behalf in Somalia, we're less willing to push for true democracy there.
But it sounds, it sounds like you may be pushing the United States there toward a kind of box of paralysis. Let's say you're saying don't send troops out to impose American values around the world, so you don't want American troops in Somalia. Here's the neighboring Ethiopia. Realpolitik might suggest that you use them, but you're saying don't do that either because that offends our values.
No, what I'm saying is that it probably was a good idea to use have Ethiopians do it. I'm not opposed to that, but I'm just saying that this means we have to compromise somewhat on pushing for democracy. We have to deal with people and countries as they are. And if our national interests required for the war on terrorism to deal with President Meles in his own terms, we have to understand that we can't promote all good things all the time with some kind of messianic zeal. We have to compromise some goals in order to achieve others. The world is more nuanced than the Bush administration has made us believe, with the ideas that once we give people democracy, everyone will want peace and freedom, and wars will end.
We're looking for
My point was that maybe there are values in other parts of the world that we might want to think about, and rather, you know, the question of whether we promote our values, whether you call it democracy or individualism, which freedom, which of course are all noble ideas. But, you know, as I say, the mindset to me is that we have all the values and that there's no point in listening to others. For example, as was pointed out before, many places in the world are much more skeptical right now about the economic consequences of, rampant globalization than the United States seems to be. In Latin America, country after country is electing leaders who are criticizing just this, free trade without any restrictions or, the flow of capital without any concern for what the impact on labor or communities are. In European countries, there's a far greater effort to create economic security and to combat economic inequality than in this country. I think it was Secretary Rumsfeld, referred to old Europe, and there's a general sense among leaders in this country that, that's all old hat, this notion of actually trying to protect ordinary people. Forget it in the modern world. Let's just let capital flow wherever it wants, and that's freedom. So we might actually learn something from other places rather than simply be concerned with how to spread our values around. Maybe there are other values out there that are worth thinking about. That's my point.
So one change in posture would be just to pull the hands away from the eyes and look around. Now, whether Americans want to adopt what they see out there or not, another question. We're looking for fresh ideas for a new year, asking, is the country ready? Is it ripe for a kind of new perspective on things? A lot of listeners want to join us. I want to begin to turn to them. Alan is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Great to talk to all of you. I have something I just want to elevate to a whole other level. The real problem we have today in the human psyche, not just America, is a need for an enemy. All those leaders were mentioned, Ahmadinejad, Chavez, et cetera, all won because they had a virulent enemy psychology. Mm-hmm. Their enemy was the United States. And even over here, the left and the right demonized the others as the enemy, as George Bush is the enemy of the left. And we've got to let go of this enemy psychology individually and collectively as a nation and a people on this planet. Otherwise, we're doomed to failure.
Does the historical record lead you to think, Alan, that we can do that? There's been a lot of enemy talk around for a long time.
Well, here's an example. Your enemy or your perceived enemy is actually the one that gets things done for you. Two major political examples would be Richard Nixon actually was able to reach out to China and establish relations, even though his party was virulently anti-communist. The Democrats could never have done that. So an enemy, quote, enemy, was able to do a peaceful move. And Menachem Begin was able to reach out to the Arabs and have a peace treaty, even though his Likud party was sworn enemies of the Arabs.
So look for some kind of
the one that could do something.
Right, some kind of jujitsu there. Alan, let us look at that. David Layton, how about it? Do you see the country, for that matter, the world, as more than usual in the grip of what our caller David describes as an enemy psychology? Is there a way out of that? Could we use some of that energy to, you know, flip it around jujitsu style with an opponent like Al-Qaeda?
Well, let me just turn the question or Alan's question around a bit. One of the ironies of the administration in the past 4 years is not so much that it's created enemies with its axis of evil, but its failure, its total failure to work with its own allies. Our relations with allies with whom we've built for 50 years close relations with Germany, with France, with Spain, these countries and their populations are more and more turning against us because we haven't worked with them. We haven't worked with our own friends, no less working with our enemies. So on the whole diplomatic front of finding common ground with enemies and working with your own friends, we have been a marked failure in the past 5 years.
Eric Foner, we spoke not so long ago with Peter Drucker. We did the last interview with him before his death, and he described something that has really stuck with me. He said he foresees the next 30 years as a painful time for the United States of coming to terms with being one of any number of significant powers at the table rather than the sole towering power. Now, is this country, from your historical perspective, are we equipped to go down that road without seeing it as an affront, without identifying the sort of bearers of that news as enemies?
Well, I'm not. We have historians have enough difficulty dealing with what happened in the past to try to figure out and predict the future.
Look at the judge from the past, then.
Yeah, I think Mr. Drucker probably had a very good point there. We are unquestionably the major, only military superpower in the world, but we have seen in Iraq the limits of military power and other forms of power, economic, social, cultural, are diffusing around the world, and we don't monopolize those forms of power the way we do military power, it seems. So, yes, we're going to have to get used to a multipolar world in which there are many countries which exercise one or another kind of authority in different spheres, and that, I think, does offer a great opportunity for us, not just a psychological challenge, but an opportunity to get more in tune, as Professor Layton was saying, with the idea of working with other countries, not just dictating to them, of, forming alliances. This business of, enemies, yes, go back in history. It does seem we need, as we say, an other. Many of our ideas are relational. Our ideas about freedom are often defined through some example of lack of freedom out there, whether it's slavery in the 19th century or Soviet communism in the 20th century, Nazism. It seems like we do need to think in terms of opposites, polar opposites, friend, enemy, freedom, unfree, etc. This does tend, as Professor Layton said, to lead us to think in very black and white terms about the world and miss all the nuances of gray and shadings of gray that are out there. But of course, the main point even of that, Iraq Study Commission is, even if there are enemies, it's much better to talk to them, and negotiate with them. That you don't, that's what you do with enemies if you possibly can, is negotiate. I mean, after all, how did the
terrorist war in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, ends. You know, the IRA was planting bombs for years. It ended through negotiation. It ended through a settlement. It's not even inconceivable we can actually negotiate with al-Qaeda, perhaps, even though they obviously are our enemy, having attacked us. But, you know, that sort of frame of mind doesn't seem to exist right now, but I think is something we ought to maybe try to go back to.
There's a different line of thought, certainly not one that's been on the table. Listeners, what do you think of it? Let me go to Stuart calling from Fernvale, Tennessee. Hi, Stuart. You're on the air.
It's a pleasure to be a part of this discussion. I'll tell you, I tend to be kind of a gloom and doomer. I don't like being that way. I feel like I'm a pretty astute student of history. There are a couple things that concern me, which mm-hmm. I'll go over very quickly because mm-hmm. there are a lot of people online. Number one, I think that because of all the things coming together in this country, baby boomers, health care, Social Security, zero savings rates, incredible debt, the Chinese holding so many American dollars, this country is a train wreck about to happen for an economic collapse. And I say that having thought about this a great deal, not a recession, an economic collapse if we don't get our priorities straight. An example, NASA keeps talking about wanting to go to the moon by 2020, have people living on the moon and go to Mars. Yet over here in Louisiana, Mississippi, the Gulf Coast area, there are people still without homes after Katrina. The priorities of the people that are running this country, in my opinion, are all wrong.
So you've got a kind of apocalyptic view there. So what's the fresh thinking you propose as the prescription, Stuart?
I think that we need true leadership, just some forward-thinking, true leaders who don't sell their souls to the big business interest. I think it's going to require leadership and bringing Americans together and saying this is going to be a struggle. There has to be sacrifice. I've never heard once the President of the United States say we have to sacrifice.
Janice is calling from Boston. Hi, Jan, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a wonderful conversation, and my mind is all over the place from the original thoughts I had. But I honestly think that this country has to really, really, look at history. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I was in Vietnam in 1971. Mm-hmm. I graduated high school in 1969, went right into the medical corps. Mm-hmm. And today, watching Iraq, and I'm having a lot of problems with so much stuff coming back. But it's like not one lesson was learned. And the whole... And this is what leading into why I think so many things have to change. Everything I hear about the comments like September 11th, the war on terrorism, I close my eyes, and all I hear is what I heard 30 years ago, put in the word communism. Not that that's the only thing that's changed. Instead of saying communism, it's terrorism.
So flip it over and push us ahead if you can. What's the new thinking or the different posture that might push us or point us somewhere else?
The different parts that has to be totally, unequivocally. There is no such thing as a war on terrorism. Terrorism is a concept. We won this. We won the American Revolution on terrorism. That's how we fought the war and won our freedom. Historically, that's a fact. We were hiding behind trees and throwing rocks. It was a form of terrorism. But we have got to totally, totally change and start talking to people we perceive as our enemies. To the whole world, when we say war on terrorism, to too many people, it's like a catchphrase for a war on Muslim. And a small portion of real sick radicals are what blew up, the Twin Towers.
And it sounds like an old dynamic to you. Let us look at it. Eric Foner, there's the Vietnam vet saying 30 years, and it all sounds like a long echo. What about the pattern in history? How does this country learn lessons from history? Does it? Do you feel we're at a moment now? You said after 9/11... this is a great teaching moment. So what do you say now?
I did, because I think 9/11 raised, tragically, all these questions about our role in the world, why people held us perhaps in a less higher regard than we held ourselves, what the nature of our relationship with people in the Middle East has been over time, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the caller makes a very good point. You know, if I were going to pinpoint a parallel between the Vietnam War and the Iraq War, it's not simply the fact that we're kind of bogged down in a completely disastrous and no-win situation, nor is it the fact that most of, we've just passed 3,000 American deaths, which is a tragedy, but hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have been killed since we invaded that country. And, you know, the price is being paid over there much more, fully than here. But the point I want to, if we're going to learn anything, I suppose, and this goes back to Professor Layton, you know, is the importance of knowledge, of expertise. The people who went into Vietnam knew nothing about Vietnam. They knew nothing about its history. They knew nothing about its culture. They knew nothing about the communist nationalist movement there. They looked at it purely through the template of the Cold War. The people who went into Iraq knew nothing about Iraq. They didn't know the difference between Shiites and Sunnis. We've learned that since. They didn't know the history of Iraq, the history of the Ottoman Empire. They looked at Iraq through an ideological lens. This is going to be the place where we are going to start the process of remaking the whole Middle East in an image that we desire. Mm. And in fact, in both cases, people in the State Department who actually had local knowledge were systematically excluded because they were considered too pessimistic and too, not black and white in their view of the situation. So if there's anything I think we should learn here is that you just don't march into a place where you know nothing about the history, culture, and politics of that region. We've done it before, and I hope maybe we can learn the lesson not to do that again.
Let me take a call from Northampton, Massachusetts. Milton's calling. Hi, Milton. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm glad to be on the show.
Great to have you. What do you see, Milton?
Well, I think it's time for us to move forward. Well, let's try the phrase, energy independence is national security. And I'm wondering if we're taking historical perspectives on things, let's look at what happened to Jimmy Carter when he said, now, America, there are some hard decisions to make, and if we're going to move ahead wisely and have a decent world to live in, we're going to have to do some stuff that we may not even want to do. And then, according to my interpretation of what's history for under 20-year-olds, he got swept aside by Ronald Reagan, who said, don't worry, America, you're the strongest and the best, now go back to sleep. And we did. We've got to figure out a way to sex up doing the right thing enough that the American public is willing to swallow it. I, for one, have faith in the United States that we could do without Middle Eastern oil. I don't have faith that we could do it easily or conveniently, but I'm a man of faith on that issue. Can we have a Does anybody want to reflect on my version of history on that?
Milton, thanks very much. David Layton, time to sex up doing the right thing. Don't call it Jimmy Carter's malaise speech. Call it, something hot. Are Americans ready for that, or is the siren song of we are the champions always the trump card here?
I think we need leadership that can combine a whole set of problems, that of energy, of the deficit, global warming, healthcare, enormous and growing inequality, social security, to combine this set of problems into a package which allows Americans to think both big and practical. And the person who can do that, to combine the big picture with the practical realities, will take us to the next stage. But let me just reflect on the previous question for a moment on the lessons of history and Vietnam. I never thought I would look to 1975 with some nostalgia when American forces left in some ignominy from Saigon. But when we left in 1975, there was an organization, a country, a government that could actually project power in South Vietnam and bring order and bring security to the population and would not threaten American interests when we left. Now, in 2007, if we were to pull out of Iraq the way we pulled out of Saigon a generation ago, the same thing would not happen. There is no one to project power. There would be internal battles. There would be spaces for terrorists to be able to live and thrive. There is no sort of promised land of withdrawal that would give us some security. So history is not repeating itself. The situation in Iraq in 2007 is markedly different from Vietnam.
And you're saying worse. We're looking for a sort of new idea structure that might help us push forward out of that hole. Jonathan's calling from San Diego, California. Hi, Jonathan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. One point I'd like to make is that it seems that our whole nation needs to go through another Enlightenment era where we pick up all the problems and all the nuances that plague our nation and even perhaps the world, and recognize and start putting into action problem-solving strategies. Because now we've got a lot of debates and whatnot, and one example of this is that, you know, we look in the prohibition era where, you know, we're going through slavery and whatnot, and all of a sudden the whole nation starts to pick up their work ethic. You know, people were drinking, now they're starting to work hard and put these ideals into use. And it seems that our nation needs that again. And so I don't know when it's going to happen. I don't know who's going to start it. I don't know if it's going to be ideology or religion that's going to pick it up. But something needs to happen, and the Enlightenment era needs to restart again. And
put those behind a kind of practicality. That's David Layton's message as well, and an interesting one. Let me get a call from London, England, if I may. Lucia's calling. Hi, Lucia. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say, I don't know if the caller before me said something similar to this, but I think that the United States really needs to deal with the environment issue. And, you know, reading the news, it's, like, pretty ghastly lately, just hearing about the ice caps melting and...
polar bears,
you know,
floating away, yep.
Yeah, yeah. Warmest winter in years and everything. And I think I've been doing a lot of research on China and the way in which China's dealing with energy and the environmental crisis. And it seems like if the Americans don't get to, get the technological edge on renewables and, a new way of dealing with energy, Chinese are right on our heels with it, and they kind of are backed more, they're more backed into a corner than we are, too. So just because the issue is, a little bit more acute there. So I think the United States really needs to take a leadership role on this. And I think this has everything to do with the issue of exceptionalism that you guys were just talking about, that, that we have to abandon our notion that we have rights to...
unlimited energy.
That it really needs to be sort of the distribution, the global distribution issue really needs to be addressed. And we as Americans, sort of on the top of the food chain heap, need to take that really seriously.
Sit up and think about it. Lucia in London, thanks very much for calling. Our time is short. Eric Foner, what about it? David Layton saying earlier, we need leadership. You said the same thing yourself on all these fronts. And yet, this is not a country that wants to wait for a political messiah exactly. I mean, maybe we can't. The country has to push ahead, has to think on its own feet as citizens, and then collectively push ahead. Do you see signs of that?
Well, I do. As I said, the vacuum at the top somewhat obscures the fact that there are, on this question of energy, there are many, many groups, environmental groups and others working to try to devise ways of freeing ourselves from our dependence on Middle Eastern oil, thinking about new ways of providing energy, et cetera, et cetera. I think what we need to do is try to use politics to harness the ideas and the commitment of, local movements, local social movements all around the country, and try to get them more involved in the political system. Right now, they're generally alienated because the way Congress has operated over the past 6 years or so has been to completely ignore these issues. And nobody, as one caller said, they're afraid of Jimmy Carter. If you tell the truth to the American people about problems, they're afraid, well, people just don't want to hear that. They'd rather hear everything's fine and dandy and we don't have to worry about it. But I believe the last election 2 months ago suggested that maybe the American people are perhaps more open to serious, realistic assessments of our current problems than, many of the political pundits might have thought.
So kind of practicality, once again, coming to the fore when we think about a new posture, sort of a bracing dose of practicality. That's a new idea in a way in itself right now. Our time comes to an end, but I want to thank both of you for being with us in this hour. Eric Foner at Columbia University, wonderful to have you. I hope we can speak again. Thanks very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome. Happy to be here.
And David Layton at Stanford, thank you very much, Professor Layton, for being here.
Thank you.
We end this hour with excerpts from eulogies at this morning's state funeral for President Gerald Ford in the National Cathedral in Washington, President Bush, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, President George Herbert Walker Bush, and others.
When we served together in the House of Representatives years ago, I watched from the back bench, I watched this good man, and even from way back there, I could see the sterling leadership qualities of Jerry Ford. And later, after I followed his footsteps into the Oval Office, he was always supportive. On the lighter side, Jerry and I shared a common love of golf and also a reputation for suspect play before large crowds. I know I'm playing better golf, President Ford once reported to friends, because I'm hitting fewer spectators. He had a wonderful sense of humor and even took it in stride when Chevy Chase had to make the entire world think that this terrific, beautifully coordinated athlete was actually a stumbler. But Ford says it was funny. He wrote that in his memoir. I remember that lesson well, since being able to laugh at yourself is essential in public life. I tell you more about that, but as Dana Carvey would say, not gonna do it, wouldn't be prudent. Now, in the end, we are all God's children, and on this bittersweet date, we can take solace that the Lord has come and taken this good man by the hand and led him home to heaven.
Gerald Ford left the presidency with no regrets, no second guessing, no obsessive pursuit of his place in history. For his friends, he leaves an aching void. Having known Jerry Ford and worked with him will be our badge of honor for the rest of our lives. Early in his administration, Gerald Ford said to me, "I get mad as hell, but I don't show it when I don't do as well as I should. If you don't strive for the best, you will never make it. We are here to bear witness that Jerry Ford always did his best, and that his best proved essential to renew our society and restore hope to the world."
Gerald Ford assumed the presidency when the nation needed a leader of character and humility, and we found it in the man from Grand Rapids. President Ford's time in office was brief, but history will long remember the courage and common sense that helped restore trust in the workings of our democracy. Laura and I had the honor of hosting the Ford family for Gerald Ford's 90th birthday. It's one of the highlights of our time in the White House. I will always cherish the memory of the last time I saw him, this past year in California. He was still smiling, still counting himself lucky to have Betty at his side, and still displaying the optimism and generosity that made him one of America's most beloved leaders. And so, on behalf of a grateful nation, we bid farewell to our 38th president. We thank the Almighty for Gerald Ford's life, and we ask for God's blessings on Gerald Ford and his family.
President Bush, Henry Kissinger, and the former President Bush speaking in tribute to the nation's 38th president, Gerald R. Ford, who died at the age of 93 on December 26th. Those remarks from Washington's National Cathedral today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.